You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 32, The Albino on the Mantle. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including the arrival of Star Trek Online Free-to-Play, ThinkGeek's Plush Enterprise, Shatner's response to George Takei, Xanadu's real-life medical tricorder, plus lots of movie news and rumors. In the feature, we're joined by Brian Finifter as we discuss the Deep Space Nine episode, Blood Oath. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How are you this week?
I'm doing great. The stores are out of milk. The stores are out of bread. I think I saw a snowflake earlier. I saw one of them. I hear there were maybe three or four in Seattle itself, but that is cause enough to panic in the Pacific Northwest. How are you doing, Chris?
I'm doing fine. We have no threat of snow here right now, although it is
cold.
But your story there reminds me of when I was growing up in Alabama, where literally if the weatherman on TV mentioned the word snow or even other words that begin with sn, people would run out and actually buy every loaf of bread and every jug of milk and every can of soup in the grocery store. And then it would never snow.
Right.
What is it about that that sends people flocking to the stores? I don't know. It's like you think you're gonna, this is it, this is the event, this is the day after everything is the end of the world.
Yeah, I mean, well, you're obviously, if it snows, you won't be able to get to the store for at least a week, and what do you need to get by for a week but milk and bread? So make sure you're stocked up on those. It was the same way back on the East Coast when I lived in Charlotte. I'm assuming there are some people somewhere who know how to deal with snow and realize that it's not cause for panic. But I have yet to live a place where that is so.
This is why snow is such a magical thing. Oh, goodness. All right. Well, yeah. Last week you wore your special show shirt, which was a real treat for people. And I do wish everyone could see you, because today I see that you have the official show drink in hand. You have your Gach and Tonic.
Indeed. Chilled in Klingon gin. And then dropped in the tonic with a couple Klingon olives. It's good stuff.
Yeah, I think they usually throw a little slice of targ liver in there as well to substitute for the lime. I was thinking about this earlier. We were talking about Gach and Tonic this week on iMessage, and I was picturing Odo doing a commercial for this drink. I could see Odo, you know, sitting at a table. He's got a bunch of Dabo girls around him, and he says, "You know, every time the Klingons come on this station, I have a Klingon afternoon. Stay thirsty, my friends."
That sounds about right. Yes, indeed. I don't always drink bloodworms, but when I do.
Oh, now we're going into advertising, since we haven't been hired, you know, to write any Star Trek scripts.
Well, after last week was brought to you by Brill Cream, I think this week is brought to you by, we'll have to find a gin manufacturer. Klingon gin, of course. We won't take any of the human variety.
Yeah. It's Captain Koloth's Gach and Tonic.
Well, I guess that could be, you know, we don't know what Koloth, Kor, and Kang were doing between the original series and DS9. Perhaps they started a gin company.
I think maybe they did, and they used the profits from that gin company to have plastic surgery to get their forehead ridges back.
Well, would you want to suffer the indignity of looking like humans? I certainly wouldn't.
That must be why they were always in such a bad mood. Because they looked like humans.
That does make sense. But I think we're getting ahead of ourselves, Chris.
I think so, too. So why don't we jump into some other things here? Greg, one thing I wanted to mention before we get into news is that I was surprised over the past week when a number of our listeners and Trek FM readers on Twitter nominated us for a Shorty Award for Fansite. Now, are you familiar with the Shorty Awards?
You know, I've heard of the Shorty Awards here and there. I've seen people nominating them. I was absolutely surprised to see people nominating us as well, or I guess you, with the site itself, Trek FM. I was very pleased to see that. I don't know how big a deal they are. Do you know who some past winners have been?
Past winners, I'm only familiar with the Shorty Awards kind of in name, personally. Mm-hmm. But the sponsorships behind it is huge. I mean, these are big companies, you know, like Bio and A&E.
Right.
And the Weather Channel, which I'm sure is a complete business failure on Ryza.
Right.
Since they have nothing to report on. I think these have, they're obviously not as big as the Webbies, but they have become pretty well known over the past year or two, I think, as social media has become bigger, because that's where they are more social media focused as opposed to just the web in general, like the Webbies are. So it's anyway, a great honor, and we really appreciate all of our listeners who have thus far nominated us. I was very surprised because we're such a young site. But, you know, I'm glad that everyone is enjoying all the work that you and I do here, and Tristan does on Hyper Channel, and Mike, Charlene, and everyone who's contributing to
the site. Yeah, so many people involved in the site. You know, every time I almost every time I go to the site, there's a new article by somebody. We keep adding people to the group. Especially love that article about pads. I believe friend of the show, Michael Fisher, wrote that article about pads. I really enjoyed that. So all sorts of great content on the site that I'm loving seeing.
Yeah, that was a fun article. I like that he starts it off with Kirk and his space water balloon mortar.
Right.
And of course, Captain Picard and the trademarked pile of pads that he has on his desk in Insurrection. But yeah, great article. But at any rate, if anyone listening does want to go and nominate us, you can. Probably the easiest way, because the link has a tie into the category, if you just go to our site, we've put a banner over in the right sidebar, pretty close to the top, and you can click on that, and it'll just take you straight over there. And, you know, we're quite far behind the leader in the fan site category right now, but after those top people, it really drops off to a very small number of votes per nominee. Mm-hmm. So if you do like Trek FM, you can go vote and bump us up pretty quickly. And if we're lucky, maybe we could even catch up with Justin Bieber.
Oh, yes. If you believe it, it will happen.
All right. So anyway, what else do we have up in actual real news today?
Greg? Actual real news is the long-awaited free-to-play Star Trek Online, which is coming up, I believe, this coming Tuesday. I'm actually completely out of it as far as what the date is, but I believe when the show is released will be Tuesday the 17th, which is right. When Star Trek Online is finally going free to play.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you're like me. I sometimes, especially because I work from my home studio, will lose track of which day of the week it is or what the date is from time to time, especially coming up the holidays. But this episode of the Radio Room will be out on Tuesday, which is the launch date for Star Trek Online free to play. And, you know, we've covered all the changes in the past and so forth, and the fact that it's going to be free and what you get for that. And there's going to be the, I think it's called gold membership, gold level, which is $14.99 a month, and you get all the kind of extra perks. But what I was interested to see here is that the site Massively, which is a big gaming blog site, quite popular, have teamed up with Cryptic to do special events for the launch of STO. And I was glad to see this because, you know, there was, I think, has been some concern, as you've talked about before, how some of the, I think, which one did you say, Star Wars, not the Old Republic, right? The one
right, Galaxies was the old MMO.
Yeah, that kind of struggled and kind of, you know, disappeared. So I was glad to see this excitement about STO free to play, that it might continue to breathe life into Star Trek gaming, because it's really such a beautiful game.
Yeah, it really is. I really hope this is going to start bringing more people into the game. You know, one weird thing about free-to-play is sometimes they get to be really, really popular even though you don't really hear about them in the gaming press. Because, you know, this is the sort of game that is so focused on the people who are playing it and adding more content. They don't have oodles of money to be spending on advertising, and they're not releasing expansion packs, so there's not much in the gaming press, but there's an undersurge of more and more people actually play. So I'll be interested to see numbers in a few months to see where STO is actually at. I keep waiting to hear, you know, big stories about it. Still, everyone's, as you said, Sweater, or the Old Republic, is getting a lot of news right now. That's what everyone's talking about. But it is something you have to pay to play. And, you know, really the only one of those that's really taken off is World of Warcraft so far. You know, Lord of the Rings is hanging on. Old Republic seems to be doing okay for now. But it's hard to maintain it, as STO found out. So we'll see as that pans out, as WoW starts going down in usership, if people start moving more towards things like free-to-play STO. Have you hopped in recently? Are you waiting for the free-to-play to turn it back on?
I'm not really waiting for the free-to-play to turn it back on, because I've actually had a membership, you know, going back from when it launched. But I haven't been in recently just because of time limitations. Mm-hmm. You know, I just haven't been able to find the time to be able to sit down. The fact that I have to boot into Windows to play it means that it's not something that I, like, if I have 30 minutes here and there, I can jump in, right, and, you know, and run around a little bit. I actually have to shut down everything I'm doing to boot into Windows. So that's a bit of a frustration. But I'm definitely going to find some time here after the free-to-play kicks off to go in and have a look around.
Right. Well, I know you'll be excited to join the Massively dance party at 4 p.m. Eastern time on Tuesday.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. You know, I'm going to move the furniture around in here a little bit, you know, clear out some space in studio and put on my uniform. And I think I'll go as a Starfleet officer for this one. You know,
there you go.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely looking forward to that. So. Well, besides that, here's just a quick list of what Massively has planned. Now, these are Eastern time here. This will be at 1 p.m. Eastern time. They have a live stream of Federation character creation and a tutorial, and they're going to be giving away 500 STO promo points for that. At 2, they're going to be giving away, it's on DS9, I guess, so DS9's in the game, and I suppose, right, this will be taking place on DS9. Mm-hmm. A costume contest for 1,000 STO promo points, and that's co-hosted with Trek Radio. 4, they're giving away, it's like an emote contest, and again for 1,000 points. 5, they've got KDF, that's the Klingon Defense Force, character mm-hmm. creation, starting missions. And at 6, they're going to do a Foundry Missions event. The Foundry Missions, this is a thing about Star Trek Online that I love that they added, I believe it was last year, where players can actually use this tool called the Foundry to create their own missions.
Yeah, right.
I really like that as opposed to the only missions that you get coming from Cryptic itself, just because, right, you know, I haven't had a chance to play many of them. I'm sure there's a lot of not great missions in there, but if it's anything like games that have these tools, like, say, Little Big Planet, mm-hmm. there are always a handful of players who are just fantastic at creating levels and creating missions in the case of Star Trek.
Yeah, there's a lot of great stuff in StarCraft 2. There's a lot of great stuff in Halo 3 that both have creation tools that people make really fantastic stuff. And the easier they make it to make levels, the more people do it. So I don't know how good the Foundry is, but it does appear that there's a lot of good missions that have been created by players, and that's always a great thing to see.
Yeah, I think where I see this free-to-play launch as being the biggest boost to Star Trek Online since it launched, probably, I think the other thing in between there was when they launched the Foundry. Mm-hmm. So that plus the free-to-play is the next big step. So anyway, at 7 Eastern time, they're having another event. It's the PvP event. And then at 8, they're doing a live stream, and it's going to be Trek Trivia for 5,000 STO promo points.
Ooh, wow.
And so that's going to be a big one there. So just everyone get ready, get your Star Trek Online software ready and head on in on Tuesday the 17th for the kickoff of the long-awaited free-to-play.
Yeah, I'm excited to see what people think. You know, if you have any listeners out there who are big STO people, go ahead and write us in your experience. You know, were there a lot of people? Was it more than usual? Was it a good social atmosphere? You know, what were your experience of the, not really a launch day, but the re-release, the new free-to-play release? Let us know how it went.
It's kind of like when the Enterprise got relaunched after its refit, right?
Right. There you go. I'm hoping for Excelsior.
Right. Speaking of the Enterprise, Greg, now I understand that you're looking for a new soft toy to, you know, cuddle up with. And I think you found the perfect thing.
Yeah, you know, the cold Seattle nights can be lonely just by myself. And what I really need is a Star Trek Enterprise plush to tide me over when there's no one around. Have you seen this, Chris? I think it's on ThinkGeek, and it lights up. It's squishy. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it does look very comforting, especially for someone like James T. Kirk. I like what ThinkGeek says on their site. They say James T. Kirk never raised a child, but if he did, that baby would teethe on a Type 2 phaser, learn to barrel roll. Before he could walk, and his teddy bear would be a plush Enterprise.
Very good.
Although exactly I think he would no, I'm not gonna go there, but I think his son would grow up to be quite a ladies' man, I think.
Yes, I'm sure he would if Kirk. Yes, indeed. I know it says he didn't raise a child. He did have a child.
Yes, and but he didn't raise the child.
Right, he didn't raise the child, thankfully. I think that's something we can all be glad for. But no, this plush is really great. I'm actually glad it's not the J.J. Abrams Enterprise. I think the original series Enterprise is much more huggable.
I think it is. I think maybe they were going to go with the J.J. Enterprise at first, but the problem was that the J.J. Enterprise also doubles as a beer keg, and you don't necessarily want your 3 or 4 year old child cuddling up with a plush toy that smells like Budweiser.
Right. Well, then they had to put a notice on it for anyone who experiences epileptic seizures because of all the lens flares.
You squeeze it and lens flares yes. come out. Yeah.
It's a legal nightmare.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. So, yes, this is over at ThinkGeek, and it's selling for $24.99, and it's actually out of stock at the moment.
Right.
But they will be getting some more in, I think, early February, they say on the site. So, clearly, it's been a very popular item.
Yes.
And
pretty much everyone who's a Star Trek fan that has a child bought one immediately. And then everyone else is going to follow soon thereafter.
Right. Only they're only claiming that they're buying it for their child. Right. They're actually buying it for themselves.
Yeah, what did I see? Somebody said that they're going to buy something for their son. Or no, they're going to buy something for the boy. And his wife said, you mean you, right?
Right. Oh, that's true. All right.
Yes, indeed.
Well, Greg, I just want to throw this out to you real quick here. Now, we've talked on this show a number of times about the ongoing feud between Carrie Fisher and William Shatner.
Right.
And I know that you love this feud and that you actually took clips of it and you created a new iPhone ringtone for yourself. Depending yes. on who's calling you, it plays either Carrie Fisher's remarks or William Shatner's remarks.
Well, now George Takei. Basically, every yes. time you text me on iMessage, it's George Takei thing.
And it is really, really bad.
So, yes, I do love this debate. You know, I've not had enough experience arguing between Star Trek and Star Wars that what I really needed to do was see actors dueling it out on the YouTubes.
Right. Well, the quick thing this week is that, of course, we've all seen George Takei's response where he tries to get everyone to band together and attack Twilight instead.
Right.
And then news came out. I saw this on TrekNews.net that William Shatner responded to George Takei. But I watched it. It's really, really short. and he's not exactly responding to George Takei's call for everyone to attack Twilight. He's just attacking George Takei to continue the feud between William Shatner and George Takei.
Right.
And he's telling Takei, like, no, no, it doesn't work that way, George. You've held this grudge for all these years, and you need to pay retribution, or something like this. So
yeah.
He says, retribution must be paid, George. I need retribution.
I don't understand where this is coming from.
It's like, let it go already.
Right. Oh, man. You know, Takei did such a good job of finding common ground, of trying to give the branch of peace between the factions, and Shatner's just coming in and blowing it all up, you know.
Yeah.
I guess that's true to Captain Kirk's character, you know. Anytime that peace starts happening between, say, the Federation and the Klingon Empire, he has to blow it all up with saying something like, what did he say in Star Trek VI, that he would never trust a Klingon?
Yeah, he said, I've never trusted George Takei, and I never will.
Exactly.
I can never forgive him for this decade-spanning feud. It wasn't the most eloquent line you've ever heard, but...
George Takei gets all of five lines in the entire series. And then in the movies, maybe he gets a starship that gets a scene or two. And this causes Shatner to have this decades-long feud with him. I don't get it.
I don't know. But anyway, I just wanted to bring it up and get your thoughts on it because, oh, man, I saw it and I was thinking, oh, okay, so what is he going to say about Twilight? Instead, it's just straight at George Takei.
I did want to ask you something related. We haven't talked about Dork Trek yet on the episode, and we're about 20 minutes in, so I thought it was about time.
Oh, it's a record, I think.
And they were talking about William Shatner and on the latest episode. And I was going to ask you, what's your canonical Shatner? You know, when you think of William Shatner, do you think of him back from the original series, from one of the movies? Do you think of the Priceline Negotiator?
Oh, you know, I think it's probably the movie Kirk, especially the movie Kirk from The Wrath of Khan, Search for Spock, Voyage Home.
Oh, that sounds about right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. No, so before he'd gotten really pudgy, but when he was, you know, he was solidly Shatner. He was well into his, 40s or early 50s. He knew the character backwards and forwards. He'd already developed the way to speak as Shatner.
I think it's at that point that Shatner is Kirk and Kirk is Shatner.
Right.
At that point. And
the two have merged.
Yes, the two have merged. So yeah, that's probably you. What about for you? Is it that same time?
You know, I think that's about right. Although I don't know. For me, it's weird because there's almost two Shatners in my head. There is the Priceline Negotiator, and then there's original series Kirk. And the movie Kirk falls somewhere weirdly in the middle for me. Like, he's not quite young Kirk, he's not quite old Kirk. And it's always weird to see, every time I see him in the movies, it's, Shatner did sort of look like that. So, I don't know. I think it's just because I watched so much original series when I was a kid, that it sort of became, and it was before I was really aware of when the show was actually shot and realizing that it was actually already 30 years old. So that sort of became fused in my head as what he looked like.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I guess so for appearance. The other thing for me with Shatner that has really established my vision of Shatner, and we've talked about this before too, is the album Has Been that he did with Ben Folds in 2004. I've listened to that album so many times, and it's such a brilliant artistic piece of work, which I know will shock people who haven't heard it, because you don't think that when you think of Shatner. But he doesn't try to sing on it, you know, it's spoken word with music. But that has really cemented my kind of view of who Shatner is as well.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, Greg, one story that we talked about a while back, and we didn't talk about it on the show here, we talked about it on the site a while back, and it's been getting some attention in the mainstream media over the past week, is the XPRIZE Foundation's Tricorder project, the $10 million Tricorder XPRIZE. And this one is particularly interesting because there is a company called Scanadu who is actually developing a real-life medical tricorder. And it's, I don't know, the tricorder, for me, for a long time, seemed like one of those futuristic devices that couldn't possibly ever actually work in real life. But yet, as technology has advanced over the past, say, 10 years with things like the iPhone and all, you know, I've come to think that, yeah, we'll probably have one of these. And it looks now like we may be quite close to having something that is a bit like a tricorder that Dr. McCoy or Dr. Crusher might whip out.
Yeah, it's really kind of astonishing when you think about what would go into a tricorder. You know, it's always been sort of a magical device on Star Trek where it's something that kind of detects anything. You know, maybe the medical tricorder has an extra little clip on, but for the most part, it does everything from find out what disease you have to what sort of rock that is.
And how many gach and tonics you've had today.
Exactly. Maybe it's time. Maybe it's time to shake that synthahol and get back to work. The tricorder does an awful lot of things, and thinking of it as a real device is quite a leap to make. But it does look like they're coming along. I guess it's just bit by bit figuring out what does a doctor mostly need, and how can we make it handheld, and then just put all of those things on the same device. It's looking less like a fantasy and more like an engineering problem. Something that just has to be worked on with a lot of R&D.
Yeah. The one that they're creating right now has like a little piece that you hold in your hand that you kind of wave around over the person. And then it's using, from what I can tell at the moment, it's actually using an iPhone as the device itself. Although I don't know if the long-term plan is to make this little one and say an iPhone application, or if the iPhone is just kind of standing in for what will later on be a separate device, right. You know, separate type of touch device. Right. And if you watch in the video, if you look closely, it looks like they're sticking like a little white, it's very small, a little white triangular item onto the neck of the patient. And apparently that little thing is picking up the... you know, your blood pressure or other signs from your body and transmitting them to this little wand, which then transmits it into the phone software to you know, run through a database of symptoms and treatments and so forth.
This does explain the Star Trek Blu-ray preview disc that I got, where Beverly has an iPhone now as she scans people. I thought it was just product placement, but really they're just trying to make it more realistic. And more what the future is actually going to be.
Yeah, right. You know, it's also, we didn't see this on the Blu-ray preview yet, but they're also going through and they're replacing all of the pads with iPads.
Right.
In the new release.
I want to be the guy who has to go in and track that Apple logo onto the back of every single pad ever used in Star Trek.
Well, you know, it seems like double work, and I don't know why they're doing this, but they're actually doing that. They're putting the Apple logo on the back of every pad. And then they're putting digitally little pieces of duct tape over the back so that you can't see the logo.
That does seem like a bit much.
Oh, but this Scanadu device here, you have to think that as the years go by, and probably in pretty short term, I'm thinking, you know, like within a decade, the little thing that you have to stick on your neck will probably go away. And they'll be able somehow to just actually read vital signs. Right. I mean, I don't know technically how that would work myself, not being an engineer, but they do manage to do amazing things. And it seems like there would be some way for them to do that.
Yeah, it's really amazing to see. And I'm really surprised that the technology is as far along as it is. I would have thought this was at least 10, 15 years away, but it looks like it's actually much closer.
Yeah, and it's a combination of the medical scanning and things that are just common to smartphones because, you know, they show in the preview video how this thing would work. You scan the child, it comes back and it says, oh, the child has this fever, so-and-so, symptoms look like this disease, take her to a medical center, and then it says, would you like me to make an appointment for you? Or it brings up a map and it shows you how to get there, and it does all these features, you know, that smartphones are able to do now.
Wow.
And so it's like a convergence of medical technology with just everyday smartphone technology.
Right.
For communications.
So will hospitals become like the Apple Store, where I can take my iPhone in and I can, you know, tap to make a Genius appointment, and I can maybe scan some Percocet and just walk out of it and pay for it with my Apple ID?
Yeah, yeah. You have to go to the doctor bar first, and then after you see the doctor bar guys, if you come in later, like the next day, you need to get a refill or something. Yeah, you just take it off the shelf and you just pay with your iPhone.
Yeah, it works.
I'm particularly looking forward to the first commercial when this actually comes out, featuring Olivia Newton-John. Scan-a-do.
Oh my goodness, Chris. Yes, indeed. That'll be fantastic.
All right, Greg, so it is time for movie news and rumors.
Yes, my favorite part of the show, along with the Gorn captains.
I know he isolates this chapter every week and probably trims it out. Probably has a playlist of just the movie rumor sections.
Right. But this was an important week as far as the movie goes, because this is the week that Star Trek II, the Star Trek 12, Star Trek Khan's Revenge, Star Trek The Tribble King, whatever you want to call it. It has begun shooting as of, I believe, Thursday. They actually had everyone on set, and they were actually filming actual film.
That's right. I think in Southern California, is that right?
I believe that's right.
Were they actually shooting on the lot this time?
I know Anton Yelkin was talking about being on the actual Enterprise set, like the bridge set, which is there in Southern California.
Yeah.
So I don't know if they've I understand they won't be going to Hawaii now, so I'm not sure where the jungle is going to be, unless they've just scrapped that whole storyline. I haven't heard much about where they're actually going on location at this point.
Yeah, neither have I. I said Southern California because I was thinking about the fact that they had been scouting locations around Los Angeles, I believe, to use a building somewhere as called a site that would be familiar to Star Trek fans in terms of, within the canon. But I haven't really heard yet for sure what that is, although I do understand they're still looking into that.
Right. I mean, they do need somewhere for Peter Weller's CEO character to be housed, so maybe that's what they're looking at. Maybe the, what is the building from Die Hard, the Nakatomi Tower? Maybe they could use that in the future.
Maybe so. But it's good to see that it's started shooting anyway, and things are underway. And from this point forward, I'm sure we're going to be getting quite a lot of movie news every week.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we're just seeing now maybe tweets from the set, people being excited, stories about everyone being together. I still haven't seen pictures, so we don't know if they've changed the costumes at all. We still haven't gotten, other than some names as far as casting like we got last week, we still don't know who they're playing. So it's mainly just a vague sense that things are happening. Things are afoot, as Sherlock might say.
That's right. Things are afoot. Well, you know, we have gotten some votes for Sherlock Holmes as the villain in the movie. So that could be a real line from the movie.
Elementary, my dear Kirk.
Oh, this is going to be our ship in the bottle in the Abramsverse episode that we were talking about.
Indeed.
So what kind of changes would you want to see? You mentioned you don't know, you know, if they've changed the costumes or anything like that. I personally love the costumes from the last movie. What kind of changes would you want to see them make in the movie?
Yeah, you know, not big changes. Mainly the problems I had was I never felt like the movie moved really fast, and I, at times I felt like it moved too fast. I never got a sense of the locations they were in. It took me something like 10 or 15 viewings to get a sense for what the bridge looked like, which, you know, you watch the Voyager pilot, and you instantly know, you know, what does the bridge look like? What does the engineering look like? And I think that's important for Star Trek as far as establishing these places as real locations. You know, if the camera's moving around so much and everything's made of glass and plastic and white something, it gets hard to make it feel like a real thing. So I'm hoping that he, along with the cinematographer, who's the same guy it's always been, Mission Impossible 3, Star Trek, I'm hoping that they can slow things down a little bit. I know it's a weird thing to say, but let's feel these locations and feel like they're actual real places.
Mm. That's a good point, because if you think, let's say, like Caretaker from Voyager, mm-hmm. even after watching that one time, you can leave that seeing in your head what the bridge of Voyager looks like.
Yeah.
You know, where the stations are positioned and what it's like. Whereas you're right, in the first JJ movie, unless you've watched it a number of times, you can't go after that and actually picture where people's stations are on the bridge or what anything really looks like.
I think it's important to be able to picture yourself walking onto that set or onto that bridge, you know, as a real place. You know, that's always a thing, you know, whether it's Battlestar Galactica or it's Star Trek, even Avatar felt like it had real life locations. And so I'm hoping that this one can follow up with that. I know, was it Damon Lindelof who said they've improved engineering? At the moment, engineering, I don't know what that was in the first film.
I think it was, Lindelof may have said something as well. I know there was a tweet from Roberto Orci that he says, "I'll tell you this, there are some cool improvements to engine room."
There we go.
Yeah.
I just hope it looks
the source of all the Budweiser in the Think Geek J.J. Abrams plush Enterprise.
Yes. I mean, I don't know where the crew is going to go for their keggers after this, but engineering is another location that it just felt like this weird slap together thing. And I understand it wasn't used much, but let's make that an actual place. Let's give Scotty a real location to play out scenes in.
Yeah. That was one of the good things about engineering, though, in that movie, is that after a successful mission, you could just go to engineering and, you know, tap the beer and have quite a little celebration back there. You know, you don't need like a 10 forward with Guinan kind of thing like on the Enterprise D. But you're right. I mean, engineering, I guess what they were going for in the first movie was to make it feel more like a real organic place, because the engineering rooms on The Next Generation, Voyager, they always feel very kind of artificial. Like you don't picture that a big starship like that would actually have such a carpeted, shiny place as their engineering. And it was so small. I mean, think how small engineering was on the Enterprise D.
It's very true, yes.
They had like a table where they could work on something, and then like 5 feet away was the warp core. And then 2 feet the other way, like you could come in the door to that room and almost bump into the person that was working on the little table there.
Right. That's very true. But I mean, you're on a TV budget. I think the idea was there, though, you know, just if everything had been a little bit further away. I did like the Enterprise, you know, the NX-01. That bridge set was really good. I liked the really long warp core that they had to actually go in and do manual fixes to.
Yeah, that seemed like an actual working engine room on the NX-01 for sure. So, but yeah, they say that they are making changes to engineering. They don't say yet what those changes are. But I guess word is that they're not going to be shooting it in the Budweiser factory this time. So I would expect engineering is just going to look completely different than the first movie. So you're going to have something there for fans of the new rebooted Star Trek Abramsverse. It's kind of the first moment where they're going to be able to debate continuity.
Right.
And
well, that was
the Abramsverse itself. Oh, okay. I see. So
I'm
now
sure
we're going to get the
I'm
real
sure there will be a non-canon novel that will explain the discrepancy.
That's right. Oh, it'll be easy. You know, the Enterprise went in after its battle and it got a refit, and this is the new engineering. So
something like that.
No one infected engineering with a genetic virus or anything like that. Nothing fun like that. So maybe it was after Scotty got stuck in those tubes and you know, floated around for a while, Starfleet realized this design doesn't work, so we've got to redesign.
We've got to get rid of those tubes.
Oh, well, what else in movie news? Now, we talked last show or the one before about the whole 3D process and shooting in 2D, anamorphic, and converting to 3D.
Right.
And of course, we've talked forever about the lens flares.
We talked a bit about the conversion. I want to point people over to Down in Front for a special episode they did, I think, 2 weeks ago. They have a little show called The Intermission where they talk about certain topics. And they actually had on two people who are in the 3D conversion industry. And they actually talked to them about how the process works, the pros and cons. Maybe I'll try to get a link to this in the show notes. But if you go to Down in Front and go to The Intermission, I believe the show is called 3AD. It's a really great discussion and something actually I was hoping to do on this show. But now that they've done it, I think you can just hop on over there and get a sense of it.
Oh, that sounds good. I'm going to check that out as well, just to hear, you know, about the process and all. I wanted to read a couple quotes here from J.J. Abrams himself talking about the 3D. Mm-hmm. And TrekNews.net had an article about this, and these are some quotes that were in there. J.J. himself, he said that it will be converted for those who want to see it in 3D, but I wanted to match the look of the first one and shoot it anamorphically, he said.
Right.
And I was glad to see that because I'm glad to see that he, as an artist, standing up to the studio about his creative vision and not just simply saying doing whatever the studio wants. For those who say that J.J. Abrams doesn't care about Star Trek and, you know, Orky and Lindelof and them don't care about Star Trek, I mean, this is another thing I think that highlights the fact that they do care not only about Star Trek, but they care about making the best movie that they can. And they care about the integrity of the creative vision.
Mm-hmm. I think that's definitely true. I mean, there's a little debate to be had about it, but I do like that he does want it to match. I wouldn't want the first film and the second film to look hugely different simply because the studio wanted it to be in 3D. And, you know, if the 3D doesn't end up looking that good, we can always just watch the 2D version and it will be exactly what J.J. Abrams wanted it to be.
Right, exactly. And he also said, I did not fight for the 3D. It was something that the studio wanted to do, and I didn't want to do it. And then when I saw the first movie converted in sections, I thought that it actually looked really cool, so I was okay with their doing it, as long as I could shoot the movie the way that I wanted to in anamorphic film, and then let them convert it. So I think he said they actually converted a lot of sections of the first movie, I guess as a test, you know, to see how it would work.
Yeah, I think they wanted to prove to J.J. that they could do it and that that a conversion would look good. I mean, they did the same thing with Star Wars. They showed George Lucas, look, that this is, you know, it can actually look good converted over. It wouldn't actually surprise me to see the first Star Trek re-released in 3D. They did that with, I mean, obviously they're having these big re-releases like the Star Wars movies, Titanic. They really re-released Toy Story 1 and 2 right before Toy Story 3 came out. Those came out in 3D. And they did the same thing with the penultimate Harry Potter film, which was released in 2D, but then there was a limited 3D release. So I would not be surprised to see probably this December, maybe early spring of 2013, the whole film just in 3D in a big re-release.
Yeah, as a lead-in to this one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At
yeah.
the very least, I'd love to see those sections. I'd love to see it converted over. And just
they could re-release it with only sections in 3D. And then before they get to that section, it'll say up on the screen, put your glasses on now.
Right. That would be really obnoxious. But I guess it's like films partially shot in IMAX, where suddenly it gets a lot more detailed and the picture gets bigger. And then it switches back and becomes grainy and widescreen again. Like, it's very confusing. Why did you do this?
Well, how do you think that one of the recent cast members that has been announced, Joseph Gott from Thor, will feel about being in 3D?
He actually should be used to 3D because I believe Thor was shot in 3D. No, Thor was converted over, come to think of it, unless I'm completely mistaken. Joseph Gott or Gat or something. All these English actors, it's impossible to know how to actually pronounce their names between how it's pronounced in England versus America versus how it should properly be pronounced by the guy himself. But anyway, this guy, I believe he was the Frost Giant in Thor. Did you ever see Thor?
No, I actually haven't seen Thor. I managed to miss most movies. So
Thor was not the most memorable of films, but the Frost Giant was a pretty epic villain. So I wouldn't mind seeing actually just the Frost Giant himself showing up in Star Trek as a villain. Maybe he teams up with Sherlock Holmes to fight Captain Kirk and the Enterprise.
Sherlock Holmes and the Frost Giant.
Wasn't that one of the original novels by Doyle?
I think so, yeah. I have the complete collection of Sherlock Holmes.
Right.
And I do believe that Sherlock and the Frost Giant is in there. I think it's about maybe like the 13th, 14th story.
That sounds about right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's the one where he travels to the North Pole. Yes, meets the Frost Giant. There's not really anywhere we can go with this bit. But no. This is another big guy. It adds to the thought that we're going Klingon in the next film.
He
definitely could be a good Klingon.
You know, he also could play an Orion.
Oh, that's very true. He could do Orion. Well, actually, looking at his cranium, I think he could go as a Talosian pretty good, to go back to our back when Benicio del Toro was going to be the South Talos police commissioner. He could be going for that.
Yeah, maybe we were close on that. Maybe the story is taking place on Talos IV, but Benicio del Toro was going to be the South Talosian police commissioner.
Right.
And since he's not in there, they're going to replace him with Benedict Cumberbatch, who is going to be a South Talosian detective as like a private investigator who's going to infiltrate the North Talosian encampment and try to figure out. He's not going to actually be able to arrest the drug traffickers, but he's going to be able to gather valuable information that he can then take back to South Talos.
That makes an awful lot of sense. Well, then North Talos is where the Frost Giant Talosian lives. So this
is
all coming together.
Cold. Really north.
Up north.
I mean, very extreme
really
North Talos.
Extreme North Talos.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But if Cumberbatch isn't actually playing a South Talosian detective, there is a rumor going around the internets this week about a possible character.
Yes. Now, this was very interesting. This is primarily speculation going on in discussion threads, as opposed to any... it's not like the Khan speculation where media was saying that they had a trusted source that said that it was going to be Khan. But people are speculating that maybe he's playing Spock's half-brother, Sybok.
What's wrong? Don't you like this?
I don't... Oh, my goodness. I can't possibly imagine that they would be going... And I don't even know why anyone would speculate about this. I mean, it's such a bizarre situation, because obviously Spock in this iteration doesn't have a half-brother.
Do you doubt me?
Or he would have, you know, been around in those childhood scenes. He would have been mentioned by somebody, you know, at this point. And what would you do with him? Would he be also on a search for God? Would they be remaking Star Trek V? You know, J.J. Abrams is going to do it right this time.
I know, right. We're going to fix that Star Trek V movie.
Right. I'm going to show that William Shatner how to direct a film.
Well, when 80s rocker John Bon Jovi is cast, then we're going to know for sure that Cumberbatch is playing Sybok and that John Bon Jovi is playing Captain Claw.
All right. There you go. That makes perfect sense, I do believe.
I don't know if there... I suppose that it's not completely out of the realm of possibility here that he would be playing Sybok. And it's not a remake of Star Trek V, but it's just... I'm just thinking about the first movie and pretty much everything that really happened in terms of a character in that movie happened to Spock, not to anyone else. So it makes me wonder, well, this whole series of movies going to be like an exploration of Spock's mental state or something, and then his half-brother shows up and... But I doubt
guess that's
it.
Possible.
It's possible. Yeah. I seriously doubt it. I'm still pretty much sticking to the whole Klingon, my Klingon theory.
Until I hear, solidly otherwise, I'm pretty sure. I don't know if Cumberbatch himself will be a Klingon, but I think the Klingons will be a big part of the film. Mm-hmm. And that I do expect he'll be at least a leader of Klingons, if not a Klingon himself. It will be weird to see him in the makeup, but that's, that's what they do. It's sci-fi. So let's take a person who looks a certain way and put him under slabs of makeup and see if he can still act.
Or maybe JJ's planning to have him play a Klingon, but keep him in one of those helmets that we saw in the deleted scenes on the DVD from the first movie. And then this whole point of, who they cast will be moot in the first place. The original series introduced us to the Klingons, and the Next Generation did a lot to develop their culture and bring the modern identity that we know of the Klingon Empire. And then DS9 in its second season bridged the gap by bringing back three of the main Klingons from the original series, Kor, Koloth, and Kang, in the episode Blood Oath. And today we're going to talk about Blood Oath, and of course Greg is here with me, and we have friend of the show, Brian Finifter, back. Hi, Brian, how are you?
Welcome.
Good, how are you guys doing?
Doing well. We missed having you on the show for a few weeks now.
Yeah, it's been a while. I've missed being on it.
Yeah, we're glad you're back. So let's talk about Blood Oath a little bit. And of course, it's the reunion not only of three famous Klingons from the original series, the three main captains that Kirk faced off with, but we actually have the original actors back as well.
Right. Now, is the Blood Oath, like last week, we sort of got the bonding, which was a brand new Klingon ritual that we'd never heard of before. Is the Blood Oath itself also a brand new Klingon ritual?
Yeah, I think it is. If you look at the Memory Alpha page, there's not a whole lot.
Really?
I think the only reference is the actual episode Blood Oath.
Yeah. I think it's new in terms of we've never heard of it before.
Okay.
On the series. But I have to say that from, especially at this point in time, how the Klingons had developed on the Next Generation, the Blood Oath is something that they can throw out there, and I can easily just say, oh yeah, that makes perfect sense that Klingons would, enter Blood Oaths together.
That's true.
Whereas the bonding, the candle ceremony where you talk to candles, seemed almost more like a Vulcan thing than a Klingon thing. So it was
it's very important to have a blue screen with very bad blue spill on the actors as well.
I don't even remember the bonding. Really, hardly at all. You'd have to refresh my memory.
That was the whole point of last week's episode, was go back and watch the bonding. But the Klingon ritual itself was an interesting element. But anyway, here it seemed like it took a long time for us to find out why everyone had done this Blood Oath with each other. It took a while for the whole story to come out. But I guess we usually start these asking about remembrances originally. Chris, you were watching DS9 as it aired. Did you feel like there had been a lack of Klingons in DS9 up to this time?
No, not really. But you have to remember that the Next Generation and DS9 were running together at this point in time. So we were getting plenty of Klingon stuff with Worf on the Next Generation while DS9 was going on. And probably because that was going on, maybe they had made a point to not do so much Klingon stuff on DS9 up until now. And even after this episode, you don't get a lot of Klingon on DS9 until Worf actually joins the show at the start of season 4.
It becomes all Klingon all the time.
Right.
Yeah, it does at that point. Although it works for me later on just because of the fact that the Federation, the Klingons, have to have this uneasy alliance against the Dominion. So I'm fine with it. Works better for me than, all Borg all the time feeling did on Voyager. But after this episode, in season three, we have the House of Quark, where Quark has to marry a Klingon. And that was...
Right.
And of course, that's basically a comedy anyway. We don't really get much Klingon. So this was the isolated moment in the first three seasons where there was a true Klingon-centric story on DS9, where everything focused on the Klingons. And the fact that they made it Kor, Koloth, and Kang. And not only that, but they actually brought back the original actors for this. You know, we had John Colicos as Kor and Michael Ansara as Kang and William Campbell as Koloth. Created for me, as someone who grew up watching the original series, it was a really nice connection there to see these characters, even though they looked like modern Klingons, seeing them again all together.
Yeah.
It was kind of a nod to the history of Star Trek that DS9 did.
Yeah, there's even a little moment where I believe it's Koloth at the beginning of the episode comes out of the holo suite, and as he opens the door, they play the original series door opening sound effect. Already at that point, they're sort of nodding at the audience and saying, look, we're doing a thing.
Yeah. The DS9 was good at that.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of DS9's greatest strengths, I think, is its ability, or was its ability, to be able to lay out this whole world that existed and really make it feel like one cohesive world, that you could see the four corners of it. So you saw, you know, DS9 was in its corner, but you could see the Klingons were over there in their corner, and eventually they, you know, sometimes they would come over to visit, and you could see the walls to it felt like the Alpha Quadrant was a neighborhood that everybody was kind of mingling around, and, you know, the right. different pieces of it, you know, that in original series and Next Generation, we would see these little isolated segments of it. We would have the Cardassian episode, or we would have the Klingon episode, or the Romulan episode, or whatever. But in Deep Space Nine, it felt like all of these different aspects, all these different residents of the neighborhood really did exist in one cohesive theater. And I think Blood Oath is a great example of that. And Blood Oath is a great example of that, not just in terms of the geography of it, but of the time and of the history of it, saying, okay, this is really connected to stuff we've already seen and characters we've already seen. And you know, the people that we saw 30 years ago, they still continue to live lives, even though the camera has been trained on them. And now they happen to pop back into in front of the cameras where we happen to be pointing at the moment, you know, this section that we happen to be pointing at. But it really, you know, being able to do that really gives things, you know, a sense of, it gives created worlds, created universes, a real sense of texture that makes them feel very real. And it gives stories a very realistic quality to them, because that they feel like real life more, because obviously real life, you know, if I'm hanging out with my friend and my friend leaves, my friend doesn't cease to exist. He's going right. off to live his own life and be the star of his own movie while I'm the star of mine. And it's, you can yeah. tell that there's that continuity of action in real life. And when people do stories well, it carries that same quality. And I think DS9 does that very well.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, then when you watch the original series, you're thinking about how Curzon was around at this time. And, you know, you watch those Klingons, and you're like, those are the guys who know Curzon. Curzon became Jadzia. And that's like really directly linking those shows. We're talking about a little bit in the before show. What did you call that, Chris, for the parts we're editing out?
The ready room, the other side of the room.
That's right, the other side of the room.
Which we're wondering if we put that out as a podcast, all the things that we trim out of the actual show, how many subscriptions will we get?
Right.
Is there anybody in the world that would appeal to?
Probably
we've had a couple
not,
people
no.
ask about it, but probably we'd get like two subscribers right. and they would only listen to it after they had been drinking heavily.
Which is when it's best anyway.
Admit it. The two subscribers would be you guys.
That's probably true. And I myself would have to drink quite a bit. But as we were saying before the show, DS9 seemed to link itself to the original series quite a bit. And maybe it was sort of a struggle to become accepted by the fans. Like TNG was trying to distance itself, it always felt like, from the original series. And DS9 is always trying to link itself to the original series. And I like that. I think it, as you say, it does add that texture. It adds connections, which are really important when creating that world. I always feel like, you know, when watching DS9, I expected to feel like this was this whole new show, but it really fit in with everything else I'd seen really neatly, and I liked that.
Well, maybe it's a case that the Next Generation very clearly wanted to separate itself from the original series and say, hey, look, we're not the original series. But at the point when DS9 came out, you know, that had all been established and had its own identity, and then maybe they felt that not only would it help connect to fans, but it was just time to kind of acknowledge the whole back history of Star Trek as a franchise as well.
Right. Well, and I guess in the original series, the original script to Blood Oath, these three Klingons were actual just random Klingons.
They were new characters.
Right, just brand new Klingon characters. And whose idea was it? Did one of you have Memory Alpha pulled up? One of the producers, I believe, said we should go ahead and make those three big Klingon characters from the original series.
It was Robert Hewitt Wolf who had that idea.
Oh, right.
That's right.
There we go.
Yeah.
So, and I think that was I don't want to call it a stroke of genius, but somewhere along the lines there, because without it, I mean, you still would have had the same story, but it wouldn't have had that connection to the original series. But I did want to see what you guys thought of it. I mean, obviously these aren't characters who really knew each other in the original series. How did you feel that them being these people we knew affected the story itself?
Yeah, I'm willing to give it to the episode because I'm a fanboy and it's a fanboy thing that they did, so I'm okay with it. But if I'm being totally honest and scientific, quote unquote, about it, then I have to say it's a stretch that the three main villains that Kirk faced in the three main Klingon episodes that there were all happened to be BFFs to each other.
Right.
And it's, you know, that the doing the thing where, you know, it's you're trying to create an enclosed world that, you know, it feels like it's enclosed is a double-edged sword, because on the one hand you want it to have that quality because it makes it feel real and consistent and textured, but on the other hand, if you go too far, you risk making the world seem way too small for what it should actually be. Yeah. And then everything becomes a contrivance. And I think this, if I'm being really honest, is it feels more like a contrivance that, oh, Kirk's three main Klingon adversaries are all best friends that are all still hanging out 150 years later or whatever it is. And so it feels like, yes, maybe it's a little too on the small side for this,
right,
to go that far.
But if you look at the Next Generation, it seems like Picard knows every captain in Starfleet. You just throw out a name to Picard and, oh yeah, that's Captain So-and-so of the So-and-so. And so, you know, Kor, Koloth, and Kang, perhaps they were the three highest, you know, most famous captains in the Klingon Defense Force. And although we never saw them together in the original series, they knew each other. And then maybe, you know, when their days in the fleet were over, they all got sent to the same retirement home. And since then, they've all been hanging out together.
The same Klingon home for elderly warriors.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm just imagining, not to talk about Battlestar Galactica again, but there's the whole backstory where Adama and Ty sort of left the fleet and got to know each other and became best friends and drank together. So it's totally a thing I understand, you know, that they would hang out together. It's a bit of a stretch that then Curzon became so close to them. I guess that goes back to the original script.
Yeah.
And that's another thing for us to talk about, the idea that they got really close with an actual Federation ambassador.
Well, I don't think that's a stretch so much, because that's kind of the point of Dax's character, more specifically Curzon's character, is that he, as that character, was the first one to really gain that respect and mutual cooperation with the Klingons that then made the relationship we see in Next Generation and Deep Space Nine possible. It's that seems very central to Dax and Curzon Dax's character. It's the fact that those three Klingons happen to be the exact same three Klingons that we saw 30 years ago or 35 years ago.
Do you ever feel like you'd rather be watching the Curzon Dax show rather than the Jadzia Dax show?
Yeah, I think it's, but I think that's something, you know, they did on purpose. It's the, it's called the, you know, the TV Tropes term for it is the noodle incident. And I think Curzon Dax kind of noodle incident kind of character where it's like it is, or Orson Welles talked a bit his character of Harry Lime in The Third Man about it was how Harry Lime was the greatest character he had ever played because he doesn't show up until the third act of the movie, and for the first two acts of the movie everybody is talking about how awesome Harry Lime is,
right?
So you spend two-thirds of the movie he's not doing anything, but people are talking about how awesome you are, and then you show up and you be kind of awesome, and it's just a great character. I think Curzon is kind of along those lines, and purposefully so. Yes, Curzon was, and you see it all the time, like, Curzon could ride a bicycle, Curzon could play the saxophone, Curzon could do this and this, and whatever you need him to do to be impressive,
right?
He could do it.
Oh, yeah. Well, when you mentioned the original script, though, Greg, and it being just three random Klingons as opposed to these three famous Klingons, I think it goes to the point of, would the story have had the same weight for you if Curzon had been friends with these three random Klingons as opposed to Kor, Koloth, and Kang, who we know, because it's those three, it establishes for us that Curzon, this not only goes back a long way into the past, but it also is that Curzon was involved at the highest levels between the Federation and the Klingon government, as opposed to just three random Klingon. Like, if we had Claw and his two frat brothers come in, it wouldn't have had the same feeling for me. Seriously,
Krug's nephew?
Krug's nephew.
That's what they should have had. Krug, Claw, and, yeah.
It's like Huey, Dewey, and Louie coming in, right? But was that an important element to the story for you, that change between the original script, which was called The Beast, and this script, Blood Oath, with the three famous Klingon captains, in terms of how it works for Jadzia and Curzon, the Dax character?
I almost think that once you get past the hump of, those are the guys from the original series, it kind of stops mattering so much that they are the people we know, because I don't feel like the characters... I mean, the characters were who they were on the show. It wasn't a matter of going back to the original series and seeing, well, where would that guy be in 30, 40 years? It was just a matter of, let's give them these names and let's have the actors play them. So I feel like the further you got in the episode, the less important that really became. And I was just more impressed with the relationship that Curzon had with them. And then as it went, I guess the whole drama of the episode was Jadzia proving that she was still honorable, that she still had a lot of what Curzon had. And I don't know if she fully proved it, but that's what we can get to. But yeah, I mean, as far as did it matter that they were those guys, I don't really feel like it did.
I think this episode gets a lot of mileage out of that, the fact that it's those three guys from the original series, and it buys a lot of goodwill. Because I think if you took the exact same episode but had three original Klingons that we had never heard of before, but otherwise the episode was exactly the same, I think it would be a much, much weaker episode, or at least we would feel it was much weaker. Mm. Because if you look at the actual story, thematically at the center of it, yeah, the idea is that it's supposed to be about Jadzia asserting herself that she's as strong as Curzon was, but isn't beholden to Curzon's life to be that strong. I think that's supposed to be the idea, and it is expressed somewhat, right? But it's not expressed tremendously well. It's okay. That's the theme side. And then if you look at the plot side of it, the actual motivations of the albino and the whole machinations of the plot and the revenge, and, is it Koloth that like conspired with the albino to basically make it a suicide mission?
All that.
Yeah. Right. I mean, there's that whole turn to it towards the end of the episode, right before the fifth act or whatever it is, that seems to kind of come out of nowhere and doesn't feel right for who these characters are, regardless of how, you know, depressed or suicidal or just kind of fed up with life he is. I can't buy that character would do that. And if he does, then I'm not on board with him as a character anymore. I don't sympathize with him anymore.
Right. Yeah, he stops being sympathetic. I mean, the moment it's revealed that he is conspiring with the enemy, It loses all sympathy. It's a kill the cat moment.
It is
for me, almost literally.
And it's, I don't believe that then what happens as a result, because the whole episode is about, right. You know, Klingon honor demands these very specific actions. And so he's broken that Klingon honor with his actions. So doesn't Klingon honor then demand some other set of actions when
right.
the Klingon honor is broken? I mean, I'm sure it's a snake eating its own tail kind of a thing, but
right.
the actual scene when they're on the, when it's Jadzia and Koloth on the bridge and she realizes it, and he admits it. After that dramatic moment of, you're just going to get us killed, right? And he goes, yeah, pretty much. Sorry about that. What comes after that is them immediately going, but if we screw with their phasers and we do this with the A and that with the B, then we can do a sneak attack. And it's like, no, the next moment after that is you challenging him to an honor duel
exactly.
or something, or
right.
the other two doing something for honor's sake or right. whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the show tried to be about a few too many things. And instead of focusing just on the Jadzia aspect, it did try to have this whole story I think you're right, it was Koloth sort of turning on them. And I feel like, you know, Jadzia had worked so hard to prove her honor to these guys that to have one of them turn out to not be honorable sort of throws the whole thing out the window. Because they should be, as Klingons, they should be showing what it means to be Klingon for Jadzia to be sort of aiming for. She should be the one who falls short, not any of them.
Yeah, I don't know. It's okay if they fall short, but the fact that she spends so much time proving herself and then succeeds in ending up being able to go, and then, you know, that kind of complication just sort of comes out of nowhere. It doesn't seem to build to anything.
Yeah.
It feels like, you know, the writing adage is, you know, write your characters right. into a corner so bad even you don't know how to get them out, and then, you know, figure it out. It's like, okay, sometimes that happens, and then on TV production schedules, sometimes that happens and you have no time to figure it out. That happens, but I feel like that's probably what happened here, and they didn't get themselves out of that corner in the best way they probably could have.
Right. Well, let me see. Chris, what do you think the episode was about, just in general? Like, how would you sum it up?
So I have a few angles on it. I mean, for me, it's primarily about building Dax's character, of course, but it's in a couple of ways. One is establishing how old the Dax symbiont is and what the experiences are. Also connecting her to the bigger Star Trek universe. In a way, you're saying that Dax is more connected to the Star Trek universe as a whole than, say, Sisko or Kira or any of the other characters are, because of the fact that Curzon was around during the TOS era and, you know, was negotiating with Kang and was involved in all these things. And
could
ride
Sisko
a bicycle.
Maybe Sisko would be more connected with the universe if he'd come out of his trailer more than, like, once.
I know.
He shows up for a scene and then goes back to his trailer and I guess plays the piano.
You can't do this, Jadzia. I'm going to. Okay. Yeah. I will say that this episode is one. I mean, because there are many episodes that try to deal with Jadzia's past lives and how mm-hmm. those lives influence who she is and whether she's obligated towards those or not. I feel this is the best, or one of the best examples, I would say, because there was. Isn't there a season one episode where she gets put on trial for something her past life did?
Yeah, for one of her hosts murdered someone.
Yeah, and that episode never really made any sense. But this one makes a certain emotional sense of, you know, no, there's somebody has the whole idea of being a host and having a Trill symbiote has been going on long enough that there's probably a very thick book of procedures that somebody has figured out going, okay, in this situation, this you do this, and in that situation you do that. So, and that you feel that in this episode when, you know, Kira and Sisko both are like, you're not responsible for what Curzon did. You don't right. have to deal with that at all. That's what the rule book says. And, you know, so it feels like, again, it feels like a real world with real texture that exists beyond the cameras, because,
yeah,
you know, people say that and it feels like somebody has already built that rule book. But then the dramatic story and the conflict comes out of the fact that even though she knows that's what the rule book says, she still feels obligated herself emotionally. So mm-hmm. I think that's, yeah, I mean, yeah. And I would have to go back and watch all of it because it's been a while since I've seen all of them. But I feel like that's probably one of the better Jadzia dealing with being a Dax episodes that there are.
Yeah, because like you said earlier, often those stories are just thrown out for her to... what her past symbionts did to, or hosts did to impress somebody. But
yeah,
like the first season episode, which I believe is Dax, where she's put on trial because her previous host, I think, allegedly murdered someone or betrayed, was responsible for the death of someone on another world, was more just establishing the fact that, hey, this character has had many past lives. Mm-hmm. And that was just throw some kind of past right. incident out there. Whereas this one actually deals more with her own honor, her own beliefs, her own yeah. feelings of what's right and wrong.
How well do you think character. It did at establishing Jadzia as a character? Like I felt like it established that Jadzia was as honorable as Curzon and, you know, had the same chutzpah as Curzon. How did you feel it did it establishing her as her own person?
Well, that was the other thing for me here in this episode, besides establishing the fact that she's the symbiont is very old and connected to the greater Star Trek universe, is also, as for me, highlights how Jadzia Dax was always this character. Although she's a Starfleet lieutenant, she's not a normal Starfleet lieutenant. She respects Sisko in the fact that he is her commanding officer, but yet Curzon knew Sisko when Sisko was, you know, coming up through the ranks of Starfleet.
Right.
So they have that kind of odd relationship. And even beyond Sisko, I always have the feeling that Jadzia is kind of another world as well. Like she's an officer on the space station. She's a member of Starfleet, but there's something else to her that she sees the world in another way. And she is, although Jadzia herself is young, her character is Dax. Kind of is ultimately going to do what she wants to
yeah.
do.
Yeah, you feel like if Jadzia got thrown out of Starfleet, it would not be the end of the world at all for her.
Right.
I mean, it definitely wouldn't be the end of the world for Dax, but even for Jadzia, she'd go off and just do something else. She'd join the Klingon whatever. She'd do that
yeah,
instead. Right.
Yeah, one of the things that I don't think they may have hit on. I think they were so concerned, or they were so enamored with the idea of this young, beautiful woman who you would think would probably be meeker than she is, than she behaves in the show. You know, they're so enamored with the idea of her being stronger than she appears because of, you know, Curzon and Dax in general, that they forget to show the Jadzia part of Dax and go, okay, this is a, you know, 25-year-old girl, 25-year-old right. woman with the memories of a, you know, 60-year-old alcoholic. And they probably could have done this, it would have served to have more of those 25-year-old scared girls pop, you know, scared girl pop up every now and then, which is, you know, one of the positives, I think, to Ezri's character in the seventh season. You definitely get that sense of, okay, here's this tiny little girl who's just terrified by the galaxy, but who now has these moments of strength and confidence and poise, but it's those two aspects clashing with each other. I feel like we spend a lot of time with Curzon and Dax's strength in Jadzia, and not enough, maybe we don't really often get a lot of Jadzia's, I don't want to say frailty, right. because I don't want to be misogynistic or sexist about it, but right. you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. I mean, well, what do you take of the ending where she doesn't kill we can talk about the albino in a minute, but she doesn't kill the albino when she clearly has the chance to. My thought is the episode doesn't get inside of her head enough to explain why she makes that decision. Is it because she wants to remain in Starfleet and she's afraid of committing murder? Is it because she is just a frailer person than Curzon? Was it wanting to maintain, I forget who was it that actually ends up killing him, but she wanted to let one of the Klingons kill him to keep his honor.
From watching it yesterday, it came across to me that she was in that moment, she was still struggling and she hadn't made her decision. And then, is it Kang? I forget which one it was, but
I think it was Kang.
We'll say it's Kang. But then Kang basically makes a decision for her, which is nice and neat and absolves her of any responsibility. But dramatically, it's not very satisfying because thematically, you're okay. What decision is she going to make? You've spent the whole episode saying this is her problem. This is the question that she's wrestling with. How is she going to decide to answer it? And then Deus Ex Machina, she doesn't have to answer it. And it's maybe that's why part of it is that, you know, this episode feels there's a really solid core here, but it just overall it's less than satisfying.
Yeah.
I think it boils down to there's a line when she's sitting and she's trying to convince Kang to let her go. And Kang says to her that you try to speak like a Klingon, but the words do not fit in your mouth. And that moment there to me is the fact that she's not a Klingon. Like she's trying to be a Klingon in this episode, but she's not a Klingon because Worf would have killed the albino.
Right,
Worf
would
have not hesitated, regardless of the fact that he was a Starfleet officer. And that brings me to a thing I wanted to ask you guys what you thought about was this whole, her dialogue establishing that she knew these Klingons, she tries to talk to them like Klingons. Like when she first goes into the holding cell and she says something like, they say to each other, "Don't you remember our old friend Dax?" And she comes in and he says, "Oh, Starfleet is, I see they sent a lieutenant to greet us. They're dishonoring us, sending a lieutenant." And then she starts talking to him as Curzon. I mean, did you buy this stuff at first? Because I thought it got better as the episode went along, but in the beginning, it didn't quite connect with me. Kind of almost pretentious from Jadzia.
That line you just quoted reminds me of what Ron Moore keeps talking about in Battlestar commentaries about how they have to write for the actors' mouths and that they have to learn what the actors can and can't say as they're writing the scripts. You can't just write any old thing and tell an actor to say it. And I did, I mean, that's a big problem with the Jadzia character. And I even don't know, is it Jadzia or is it Terry Farrell or what is going on? But so many times she says something that I don't buy.
Yeah.
And I liked kind of how in this episode they totally called it out. And one of the Klingons just said, you know, you can't talk like that anymore. You know, you're not that sort of person anymore and stop trying to pretend. And I felt like that was them finally hanging the lantern on the fact that this is a 20-something girl and she can't just be acting like Curzon all the time.
Yeah, I think, and I don't know if that was intentional in their part because, I mean, this episode is still fairly early in the show's run. It's, you know, season two. So I don't know if it was intentional at that point or not of them saying, okay, whenever we have Terry talking about the Klingon stuff, it just really doesn't sell. And so what can we do? I don't know if they had that realization that early or not, but that's definitely the impression that comes across. And it's, I think they were making the best, they were making the most miles out of a poor situation that they could.
Right. Also, I just felt like they kept playing the same note too, where she's always trying to prove herself, and it's the same scene, especially with the three Klingons. She has to prove that she is Dax three times in a row, and then she has to prove that she has honor three times in a row. I'm not sure what direction I would have gone in, but I did like bits of it, is the thing. I liked parts of the conversations. I liked when she was told that about talking like Jadzia, not trying to talk like Curzon. I liked, I didn't like the Batleth fight with, I think it was Kang. It was very silly and swinging it around.
Well, I do want to talk about the Batleth fight,
okay,
Greg,
let's
because
go ahead and do that.
I know that you do love Batleth fights. And this one, I thought it was one of the moments in the episode where, so Jadzia has to convince Koloth at this point that she should go. And so she goes and does the classic Star Trek move, which is to go onto the holodeck and do the Batleth boogie, which is where you, as a non-Klingon, order a Batleth from the computer, and then you fight an actual Klingon to prove that you are strong and worthy of them. You know, she does it with Worf when he comes onto DS9. I think Riker does it with Worf on The Next Generation.
Which, can I just point out as an asterisk, I love how she makes a big to-do and a big deal about, you know, specifying each and exacting specification for the Batleth.
Yes. That's the
and then
that's
it looks exactly like every other goddamn Batleth we've ever seen.
I know.
It is the stock Batleth.
Yeah, I know. That's what I call her J. Peterman moment, where it's like the J. Peterman catalog from Seinfeld, where she says, "Computer, I want a Klingon Batleth, tip to tip, 160 centimeters. Weight 5.3 kilos, with exterior hand gripping." Diameter of 5 centimeters. Blades of composite baconite.
I just picture the computer going, yeah, Batleth, got it, done.
I know, yeah, it's like, exactly.
Can
it's
I go
like
back to the fusion reactor right now? Because that's going to blow if I don't look at that in the next 5 minutes. Are we good? We're done here?
It's like on, I think it's, is it on Voyager when Paris goes and orders soup and the computer asks him, like, hey, do you want this or this or this? He's like, I just want bloody soup, you know, just give me soup. Yeah, the computer's like, Batleth, here you go. Right. And then Kolas says, a warrior's configuration.
Right. Like, exactly like his.
I mean,
and I'm sorry,
do they have Batleths for everyday use?
Is there a warrior
configuration.
Non-warrior
there's a schoolyard configuration.
There's the one you use for cutting your steak. There's the one you use for hunting.
Well, I mean, it's probably like a Team Fortress thing. You probably have your medic Batleth and your spy Batleth and your soldier Batleth.
Right. Okay, but when you fight a Batleth, okay, so imagine, listener, if you will, imagine a Batleth. It is a gigantic blade made up of blades. They're kept razor sharp. There are 4 to 8 points. You can stab someone, you can slice someone. There's a lot of blood, basically, involved. Anytime you start swinging, you're probably going to cut yourself with the Batleth eventually, but you're certainly going to cut your opponent. But what do we see on DS9, on TNG, on Voyager? You hit someone with a Batleth, there is a punch sound effect straight out of the Indiana Jones movies, and they just fall over backwards, bloodless, completely, you know, together, you know, no limbs chopped off. Nothing ever happens other than a punch sound effect, and they fall back.
And it's the same things, it's the same moves every time. It's like the uppercut and then the sweep down. And it's, you're slicing
at
these people.
And then stop to sort of swinging in your hands. You
know, which they
the
do
handles
a ton of times in this, you know, it's the lightsaber twirl of the Batleth.
Yes.
But it's so awkward and terrible looking.
Yeah. Which reminds me, have we ever seen a Klingon wield two Batleths at the same time? Like General Grievous?
I imagine we have, actually.
We must have.
I have to
go
back
and
see. Yeah.
You make me curious. But, yeah, I mean, the Batleth looks very cool, but, A, I don't think in the real world it would ever be. But that's fine. I mean, there's plenty of weapons in the real world that are completely impractical, that are, you know, look ceremonial. But the problem is the Batleth is the one and only go-to weapon for the Klingons.
Right.
And then, yeah, the other issue is that they don't actually, for being swords, for being giant curved two-handed swords, they don't actually cut anything. I would love to see the Game of Thrones version of Star Trek where when you did that uppercut thing that they always do, you actually take the guy's head off. That would be great, but that would not be family television that Star Trek has to be.
You have to not watch the television. I was laughing uproariously in the whole end fight scene. I felt like the script writer, the production designer, the fight choreographer, none of them realized they were on TV. You know, they have a TV budget, they have TV censorship rules, they have all sorts of things. And the whole end of the episode was, a Game of Thrones thing that might happen on HBO where there's blood and guts everywhere. But that's the only way you can get away with a huge Batleth fight as your climactic battle without it looking utterly ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah. But hey, the Star Trek has a lot of great things going for it. Its fight choreography is not one of them.
Right. Yeah.
Can we also briefly, while I'm complaining about the ending, can we bring up the albino and what was that supposed to be? Because he clearly kind of looks like a Klingon, but from dialogue, he's not a Klingon.
Yeah.
What happened there? Any theories?
it's very confusing, and it's another TV trope is the law of conservation of detail. You know, don't have a specific and noteworthy detail that kind of pops out in your mind as specific and noteworthy unless it's
right.
It pertains to the story in some germane or important way. And so the albino, the fact that he's an albino, feels like it should mean something or have some kind of payoff or be some kind of
the albino on the mantle.
Yeah. And it's like, and if you look at him, he looks very Klingon-like. And yeah. So, okay, he's an albino Klingon. That makes sense. And that's kind of a cool concept. It's something we've never seen before. We have never seen since. And maybe the albino is, him being an albino Klingon is thematically, it makes sense because he's a dishonorable Klingon. So he's not dark-skinned and he's white-skinned. He's an albino, blah, blah. But then, so that all seems to like sort of almost add up to something that makes sense. But then in dialogue, he refers to them as Klingons, implying that he's not.
Yeah, filthy Klingons.
It's just confusing. And it's the worst thing you can do, which is start to build up to something and get almost towards some kind of dramatic destination, but then just fall apart before you get there. And, you know, sort of, it looked like you're building towards something, but then fall apart before you actually get there.
Yeah, you leave that confusion. It's like in Stormfront on Enterprise, which came out not too long after Nemesis was in the theater, and they end up, you know, getting thrown back in time on Earth, and you have these aliens with the Nazis that look like Riemanns, but they're not Riemanns.
Yeah,
but they look like Riemanns. But they made them look so distinctly like that it creates confusion. And here, you go along the whole episode, and you're never thinking that this albino guy is a Klingon, and then you get there and he looks like a genetically mutated Klingon.
Yeah.
Right.
Essentially. Yeah. And it does leave a lot of confusion.
Well, you're talking about that character where you spend the first two acts talking about how awesome he is. And then he shows up, you know, here's an episode where we spent 90% of the episode talking about how horrible and evil the albino is. And when he shows up, instead of being this, oh, that's the albino, now I understand. It's, wait, what? He's dead now, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah, wait, and so is he like some sort of alien, like, drug lord, kind of? Because he's got his own cartel compound.
Right.
He used to raid Klingon colonies, I think, is the backstory to the
Albino. Yeah, that they mentioned at one point. But the problem is, you know, you need your characters to act and react, and if your character is going to be extraordinary, they need to actively do extraordinary things. And so the great thing about Harriet Lime is that he does, and it's implied, but he's doing really crazy crap that makes you as the audience member go, I can't believe he did that. And so in the Blood Oath parallel, they spend 90% of the episode talking about the crazy things the albino did, but then when we actually see him, and we do spend a fair amount of time with him towards the end of the episode, he doesn't really do anything really that diabolical or evil or
he was just like the standard stock villain in Star Trek. Yeah. I mean, at one point when they're attacking the compound, he like walks down the staircase and he just says, report.
Yeah,
I thought, well, that's what you would see like in Insurrection with Admiral Dougherty or something would say. And speaking of makeup, I'm pretty sure that I saw Tosk working with the albino as one of his guys in his compound.
Maybe even
more than one Tosk.
Hey, you guys, you don't know, but film production is a terrible, terrible, soul-sucking. It just keeps moving, and if you're not ready, then you're just steamrolls right over you. And film production is tough. I will give Star Trek a lot more leeway now that I've spent several years working in film production than I perhaps might have in my earlier years.
Yeah, knowing what it's like. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, elements of this show definitely feel like they got hit by the steamroller of film production. But there were elements I liked as I was trying to say that I did like the, you know, what we got to with the Jadzia character, where we're we're dealing with not so much as her being held liable, but her dealing with what she felt was important about her past lives. That was interesting. I really liked the conversation between her and Kira, where she's sort of asking Kira, what was it like to be a terrorist? What was it like to just go around killing people? Did you feel it? Were you able to separate yourself from it? How was that scene for you guys?
And that to actually contradict what I said earlier, where I felt we don't get enough JadZia moments. I feel like that's definitely a JadZia specific moment. That's absolutely JadZia asking, hey, what is it like to kill somebody? Because Curzon has probably killed somebody, and we know other of our hosts have definitely killed people. That is definitely JadZia asking, who has never done it before, and is just a 25-year-old woman, you know, what is it like to kill somebody? So I like that. That may be the greatest scene in the episode, and one of the best scenes, I think, in Deep Space Nine.
Well, also in that scene, it reminded me how, say, on The Next Generation, you often have, I mean, you have characters who have nothing to do and get very little character development. And at this point in Deep Space Nine, the show is still episodic. We're not into the serialized DS9 storyline that we came to know yet. But it's also an example where DS9 continues to make the threads of the lives of the characters matter, even through these kind of bottle shows where Kira had nothing to do in this episode in terms of the storyline, but yet she did have this moment with Dax. She had this conversation with Dax, which, like you said, gave us a glimpse into Dax's mind or JadZia's mind, but it also helped to continue to further Kira's character, even though it was such a brief moment.
Yeah.
As opposed to, say, Sisko, where he just comes out twice and says, oh, you can't go. Oh, you're going. Okay, I'm okay with that.
I really felt like Sisko was contractually obligated. I guess Avery Brooks was contractually obligated to appear. But yeah, as you say, the Kira scene, they really made the most of that. And I liked how they, in TNG, I feel like someone would have asked someone a question and they would have answered it. But here, Kira's clearly uncomfortable and doesn't want to talk about it. And then they talk about something else for a little bit, and then Kira comes back and gives the advice that she needed to give. It felt like a realistic scene. It felt like a great scene between the two of them. And it's, I forget the name of the rule, but there's the rule of, is it possible to have two female characters have a conversation not about a man?
Yeah. Hang on.
I should know the name of this rule.
Keep talking. I'm going to look it up.
It's like Alien is a film that does that. But really, it's really hard to find it. What is it?
Bechdel test, if I remember right.
Yes.
That's what it is.
That's exactly right.
Which reminds me, on The Next Generation, you get Troy and Beverly together, you know, doing stretches or something. Mm-hmm. And what are they talking about?
Exactly.
They're talking about some guy alien who's on the
They're
ship.
They're talking about Wesley or Picard or some alien. Yeah. Every time. And here's a case where, I mean, maybe they're talking about the albino, but really they're just talking about killing and what that's like. And like it's an actual important scene. So, hey, here's a DS9 doing something that isn't done, especially in science fiction, especially on television in the 90s. So, yeah, good job.
So one other thing to talk about real quick, Brian, you brought up in the ready room, the other side of the room, about whether Deep Space Nine, this story in particular, I guess, is a model for what maybe Enterprise should have been as a series.
Yeah, well, I mean, that goes back to what I was saying earlier about, you know, when you build a world, a fictional universe, it should feel like it has walls and feels like it's self-contained to an extent, that you can see the various corners of it. And it's probably the most difficult thing in the world to do that for a franchise like Star Trek that spans 40 or 45 years at this point of supposedly one continuity, you know, discounting the 2009 film, where supposedly all of this stuff is supposed to interconnect as if it belongs in the same universe. And the promise of prequels, you know, as much the Star Wars prequels as Enterprise, is to do essentially that, to show you other corners of that's not only that space of that fictional universe, but also that the time of that fictional universe, but to show you how those corners and different points connect to each other. And Enterprise, at least in the beginning, didn't do that at all. It sort of started to do that towards the end, but it was too little too late. But that's the idea of, that's kind of the promise, at least what the promise of Enterprise was supposed to be is, yeah, we're going to show you these other corners of this universe and, you know, fill in the holes in the map. And it didn't really do that. And this is DS9 doing that, saying, okay, here are these characters that we've seen in this other corner, and now we're going to bring them over to this corner and see how those two corners kind of connect to each other.
Very true. I like how it's not about Starfleet or the Federation at all. It's most Klingon episodes are about how the Klingons interact with the Federation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even The Trouble with Tribbles was about that. But this is entirely, I mean, sure, Desi's a Starfleet officer, but this is entirely about her as not one and her proving herself as not a human being, as a person, and dealing with honor and all of that. So that's one thing I love about this episode. I don't know how many times Star Trek does that, where it manages to tell a story not in the Starfleet box.
Well, that's one of the great reasons, one of the great things of DS9 in general, and this is, I think, one of the early examples of DS9 doing that really great, is the sense that it takes a look at these various cultures, not just the Klingons, but, you know, the Ferengi and other cultures, and it doesn't judge them the way the Next Generation tends to judge them, or definitely the original series, with, okay, you Klingons, you're warlike, or you Ferengi, you're greedy and capitalistic, and that's bad because we are the Federation and we are generous and self-righteous and really fucking smug about everything. And the original series and the Next Generation carry this real sense of superiority about that moral judgment. But Deep Space Nine is really good and really interesting when it says, no, this is who the Klingons are. There's nothing right or wrong about it. That's just who they are, and it's as valid as who you want to be. I mean, it's remarkable in the sense of how little attention is paid to it. But the whole episode is based around these guys seeking revenge for something. Just totally seeking flat-out Ahab-like revenge on this character. I mean, to the extent that White Whale and Albino, on that parallel, is probably conscious. Maybe, maybe not. But whereas a Next Generation episode kind of built around that same foundation would judge them, I think. And the episode would probably be about, you know, Picard trying to convince, you know, say it's Worf running off with these three Klingons. The episode would be about Picard trying to convince Worf not to do this.
Very true.
And it's not, this episode of DS9 is not about that at all. And that's the real strength and the real interesting, compelling aspect of Deep Space Nine, when it does really well. And this is, other weaknesses of the episode, this episode is a great example of that.
Yeah, on the Next Generation, in that case, we wouldn't see Kor Koloth and Kang interacting very much. We wouldn't see much of the reasoning behind what they're doing, and we might not even really see the end result of it all. It would be focused on Starfleet regulations and Worf's own personal struggle.
And Troi telling Picard that she felt like maybe they wanted revenge, she thinks.
Yes. They feel angry to me. Yes, thank you.
But I'm not sure what about, because it's hard to filter out the emotions of the crew.
And, you know, I feel like there's part of the weakness of this episode is the sense that's, okay, Jadzia Dax now has to wrestle with this, whether or not she's going to participate in this blood oath, but that if she does decide to go through with it, if she decides to kill the albino, she has to deal with those ramifications as a Starfleet officer now, as a member of the Federation. Right. If she does this, she will be put on trial for murder, or she will be court-martialed, or whatever. And she has to deal with those consequences now that she's a Starfleet officer. Although it doesn't quite follow, because Curzon was also a member of the Federation, and presumably also would have been put on trial for murder. So,
But he was not an officer, I guess.
He wasn't an officer, but, you know, he was a diplomat. Yeah. But, and that depends on how the Federation legal system works, which we probably shouldn't even get into.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that idea of, okay, she feels emotionally responsible for this act that occurred to her previous self, but now she'll have to deal with the ramifications as Jadzia, not as Curzon.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I do agree on all that, Greg. Like you said, the Star Trek in general doesn't do very many episodes that don't focus in some way on Starfleet or interactions with Starfleet, but the exception is DS9, which does it quite often, actually. And does it very well, but it's because of the unique nature of the series.
Yeah. And it's a big reason of why Deep Space Nine is so interesting as a TV show, because it really just, it's, here are these people in this situation, and we're not, the point of view is broader, the perspective on it is broader than just this very narrow kind of, okay, these are these perfect humans and everything they do is right, and it's black and white that way.
Yeah. So as we close out, Greg, Brian told us what he sees as the weaknesses there, and of course we talked about strengths as we got along too. What about you? Any final thoughts on strengths or weaknesses of the episode?
I guess in general I think of the weaknesses of the episode being just that I felt like the production design, the TV budget wasn't there for the story they were trying to tell. They wanted this big feature size fight scene at the end, and they really didn't get it. They wanted, I don't know, I feel like they wanted those scenes in the middle to have more emotional weight than they ended up having, just because I felt like there was a lot of repetition there. I know Terry Fowler was talking about the three different things she had to prove to the three different Klingons, like her strength and her devotion and her honor, something like that. I didn't really get that out of the episode itself. I felt like it spent a lot of time just her proving vaguely that she was still Curzon or that she still had honor. So it was stronger in concept maybe than in the finished episode, which, you know, they had to make this episode in a week. They had 5 days to shoot it. They had, you know, maybe a couple weeks to write it. So I completely understand. I would like to see it and look at it in the terms of the larger Jadzia arc. And I wanted to ask you, before we finish, Chris, is Jadzia different after this? I mean, can you really tell in the stories that she grew as a character from this? Or is it just another case of them dealing with it and they're just going to keep dealing with it until she eventually is killed off stupidly in season 6?
Yeah, I think that it was important character development. I don't know that you see like any immediate change in terms of like, oh, suddenly Jadzia is a very different person after this. At the beginning of the series, she's much more the young girl that occasionally has these wise man moments, especially when she talks to Sisko. But outside of that, she's more the girl. For me, in this episode, one of the weaknesses is that I just had trouble buying Terry Farrell's delivery of the lines, especially early on, where she's supposed to be, she's channeling Curzon, and he was, you know, had his understanding of Klingon culture, and he was a Trill, but a warrior going out, you know, and partying with these Klingons. I just didn't buy all that. I thought it got better as the episode went on, but I think that the character of Jadzia later in the series, when she is dating Worf and then is married to Worf, I think that she fits into the whole Klingon thing better at that point. Maybe it's because this is season 2, and, you know, Terry Farrell didn't quite know at that point how to play a Klingon, and the whole Klingon culture was evolving as well. And with this being a story that focuses on these three famous Klingons, and then she has to kind of fit in as one of them, had to be a difficult thing to do. Mm-hmm. So I think it was important for her character, both in showing how old the symbiont is, as I mentioned before, as well as her interactions with Sisko, the fact that we see that Sisko is not going to be able to kind of control her the way that he might be able to control other officers. And then we see that come in later when Worf comes on as well, because, you know, Sisko has, as Picard did as well, have some difficulty handling Worf's Klingon heritage and impulses, which I think became stronger for Worf when he was on DS9, because he was in an
environment.
He just
wanted to bond with everybody.
Well, he was in an environment on DS9 that allowed him to express his Klingon side more so than he could on the Enterprise. But you see that here with Dax and Sisko, it does a little bit to further the development of their relationship, and a lot for Jadzia, but I don't think it's like a night and day, like after this episode, suddenly we have a new Jadzia. It's something that evolves over the course of the series. All right, well, this was a great chance to talk about Deep Space Nine, which I feel like we don't do enough on this show, considering that it's my favorite series, and I know you guys both are quite fond of it as well. But always fun to talk about Klingons, and there was one line in this episode. The beginning of this episode is great. I just wanted to point out Quark's view of Klingons, where he's walking with Odo, and he says, "What are they doing?" And Quark says, "Oh, well, they're up there doing the Battle of Khog Dog Rog or some such thing like that." Quark's imitation of Klingons.
I love that scene between Quark and Odo in the beginning, definitely.
Yeah, yeah, it's great.
Shut it down. No, they said they'll kill you. No, they said they would kill you. Shut it down.
Right. Odo is great in this episode, too, when he also... that's the way he talks to the Klingons. You know, Odo is this, I'm not going to take any crap from anybody.
Yeah, it's very much it's just, I mean, he even has a whole little speech about it's a Klingon afternoon kind of a thing. It's like, it's a very relatable thing. It's, we've all had those days at work where we go, oh, okay, it's one of these days. Okay.
It's been a Klingon afternoon.
It's a Klingon kind of day.
All right. Well, before we go, Brian, why don't you tell everyone where they can find you around the web?
Sure. As always, you can find me. I'm a host on a podcast called Down in Front, where we record our own commentaries to movies. So we sit down and we basically do a commentary, like a director's commentary, like you might find on a DVD, except it's us instead. And it's really fun. It's kind of a combination of a director's commentary slash, you know, MST3K slash just kind of a fun conversation. We do have those. We release those once a week, and you can find those at downinfront.net. This last week, we just did Wrath of Khan, which I had been waiting to do for a very long time. So, if you're a Star Trek fan, it's probably worth checking out for you. And then, we're changing formats very soon. We're not going to do those as often anymore, and we're going to switch to a more traditional podcast kind of a format and just kind of have conversations about movies and the industry. Myself and all of my co-hosts, we all work in the entertainment industry here in Los Angeles in various capacities. So if you're interested in movies and the industry particularly, that's worth checking out. So you can find that at downinfront.net, and you can also find me on Twitter at my name, Brian Finiter. And I think that's it.
Very good.
Very cool. We'll put a link to your Wrath of Khan thing in there, specifically in the show notes.
Awesome.
I'm looking forward to checking that out too.
As you say, Chris, it is always good to talk DS9. I try to make sure that we have a third person on every time because my DS9 knowledge is a little bit limited. But I feel like we had a good discussion about Blood Oath and Jadzia, especially. Jadzia is probably my favorite character from DS9, especially in the early years before they got into the whole Dominion War thing. I find her just really, I find that concept at least fascinating.
Yeah, I like the concept as well. I'm not sure that always is pulled off to its best and to its potential, but certainly evolves as the series went on. I think definitely Jadzia became a very interesting character. Well, I'm glad we could have Brian on with us again this week as well. Actually, not again this week. It's been about a month or so, and it was about time to have Brian back with us.
Yeah, I told Michael Fisher we couldn't have him on 3 weeks in a row, or by union rules, we would have had to start paying him, you know, real wages. Offer him catering and all these things, benefits basically. And so hopefully Mike will be with us soon, but yeah, it was great to have Brian back with us.
That's a good point. All right. Well, let's tell everyone where to find us if they want to share their thoughts on what we've talked about today. You can go to trek.fm/contact and send us a text message there. And if you want to leave us a voicemail, you can call 646-652-TREK. And you'll find us on Twitter at username TrekFM, where we're talking about Star Trek Round the Clock. And Greg, everyone can find you on Twitter as well.
Yep, you'll find me there at Greg Harbin, talking about Snow and also being knee-deep in my Battlestar Galactica rewatch. Just finished season 2, so that means I'm about halfway through and I'm about 10 episodes after it stopped being the greatest show on TV and just started becoming a pretty good show on TV that has huge problems. So it's it's almost more interesting at this point, but it's also kind of disappointing after the amazingness that is the first season.
Right, but you are into the whiskey phase now, right?
Yes, he definitely. Mrs. Ron is now on every show. He has whiskey every single show for sure, and smoking every time Mrs. Ron's not there.
Ah, right. Well, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is CBrianJones. I'm just talking about all kinds of crazy stuff, Japan, football season's over now. My alma mater won the national championship. I have to throw that out there. So Ooh. I'm happy about that, but probably less football talk for me now until August rolls around. But you can find me there. You can also find Trek FM on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM and on Google Plus at our own short link, hyperchannel/TrekFMG+. Don't forget, you can find Ready Room on Stitcher now. If you happen to be streaming this from our website and you've made it all the way to the end, congratulations on not closing your browser window before the show was over. And next time, if you don't use iTunes, where you can get the enhanced podcast, you can also get us on Stitcher in your Stitcher app. And I also want to thank everyone who's given us a rating or a review on iTunes. We got a couple more, Greg, and we really appreciate that, everyone, and it helps people, other fans, find the show. So if you do feel inclined to leave us a rating or a comment, we especially like getting comments because we like to just hear your own thoughts on what we're doing. And it's nice to know that someone is listening to our ramblings. one more thing that I've forgotten to mention the last couple of weeks. If you want to test your Star Trek IQ, you can play Trek Trivia. You can do it on our website at trek.fm/trektrivia. And you can follow username Trek Trivia on Twitter as well for live quizzes a few times a week. Well, Greg, I'm going to go and record my own video response to George Takei right now.
All right, Chris. Yeah, I think it's time to punch it with a bat left, because the Ready Room is done.